So here we are starting our 60th lesson in the Gospel of John, and I've entitled it Starting the Sacrificial Examination. John 18:1 starts out with the little band going across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. He doesn't name the garden. It could be the Garden of Gethsemane, or it could be a smaller garden. Maybe this is just another move. It's really hard to say. And even when we compare all the Gospels together, John is different. He doesn't include much of the details that the Synoptic Gospels did. He focuses on other events during that last week, either from a different perspective or events that the other Gospels did not cover at all. So it makes it very difficult to be precise and adamant in saying factually that this happened here and this happened there and da da da. If you were to follow just John, you would reach the conclusion that Christ stayed in the upper room during the Passover meal, during much of the teaching, and now here he is moving out and coming to the garden. But you look at the other Gospels, and that's not what happened. Christ and the apostles left after the Passover meal. They sang a hymn and left. The room was probably stuffy. We get the idea that this is a fairly warm night, but we won't get to that part until the very end of this lesson. But for right now, just recognize that it was a warm night. And so they went out into the darkness, into the cooler evening, but not cold, just cooler than being in a stuffy, isolated upper room where they could stretch out and enjoy the evening reason, listen to Christ, and not be interrupted by crowds or people who wanted to see Jesus to be healed and all those things. He wanted to focus strictly on these 11 men. And we've gone into great detail because John has gone into great detail on the teachings of Christ on this last night. And as we said, this closes out his gospel ministry. What is happening now is the examination will begin. Now, what is this examination? Well, if you turn to Exodus 12, 1 through 6, you'll see that on the 10th day of the first month, Nisan, the people were to get their lamb, and they were to watch over it until the 14th day. And so for those 4 days, they were examining the lamb to determine if it had any defect. And that was the point. It had to be without defect on the outside. And so that's why they watched it for 4 days. And then they would take it to the temple or to the local Levitical slaughtering place and slaughter it, flay it open, and examine it on the inside to see and make sure that there were no inner defects. Well, Christ is now the true pastoral lamb. Now, he's been examined throughout his ministry. He started off after the baptism, being driven into the wilderness and being tempted directly by Lucifer. And then when you read the events in the other Gospels, you'll see he's actually being tempted and tried throughout his ministry. And this night, we're going to see that he's still going to be tempted. Is he truly without sin? Is he truly going to maintain the control over the flesh, which, as Meshua, you must do that. As we talked about with Cain, he was supposed to be the Meshua, and God told him directly, sin lies at your door and you must control it. But like all men, he could not. Sin controls him, sin controls us. But Christ, being sinless and being the beloved begotten of God, did control his flesh. His flesh had no sin. That's why he's called the last Adam. Just like the first Adam, who started out with a body of flesh that had no sin nature. And so these events that are transpiring are going to show us how Christ is being examined. Is he going to remain sinless, not just on the outside, but his whole inner nature? Is he going to remain sinless? Because one sin destroys everything. He would be found unclean and unable to be the Paschal Lamb, and his death would be meaningless. And there would be no salvation. So much is riding on this. In fact, the whole point of creation comes down to this night and tomorrow. Everything. And it does. It changes everything, like we've talked about it in past lessons. Now, if you notice the graphic here, and I hope you are following along and using the graphics, it helps to focus your mind on the teachings. Plus, I do not cover all the biblical texts that are on the graphics, or included in the graphics. But on this particular graphic, you notice I have it numbered. And for you eschatological buffs, it shows the seven hills of Jerusalem, Old Jerusalem. Because the passage in Revelations that is mistakenly interpreted to mean seven physical hills, and thus it corresponds to Rome that was built on seven hills. Well, Rome was not the only place built on seven hills. And as I've discussed in my studies on eschatology, I believe, the seat of power of the Antichrist will not be Rome, though he will be of Roman lineage in some point or fashion, which would include all that territory that Rome had conquered, especially up to the time of Christ. His headquarters will actually be in Jerusalem. Judas, of course, knew where Jesus took the apostles for teaching. Teaching that did not benefit him. And Judah brings his entourage to the same place for a very different purpose. The betrayal. Now, nearly every major historical event is linked to the love of money. And, of course, we've discussed how that drove Judas. Now, he didn't want a lot of money. His ambitions were tiny, as it is of most people. Their ambitions are very tiny. Even Lucifer, who wants to control the whole world, that's very tiny compared to the entire universe. He's not trying to control the universe. He's trying to control just one little planet. Very tiny. As the scripture says, that when we will see him, when we'll actually have an opportunity, outside of this body, to see him, we will be astounded and say, is this the one who did all this? What? He's nothing. But right now he appears to us to be everything. And we do fear him. But not in the medieval sense, because he's grotesque and he's terrible and all that stuff. That was just terrible. None of that was in the scripture. None of that is true. He doesn't take form and shoot bolts and flay people alive. None of that stuff. That's more akin to the practices of paganism. But he works through our lust, our covetousness, because that is what entices the flesh. As we've talked about before, and we're going to see it again later on in this lesson, in the 10 words, covetousness is the basis, is the foundation for every other sin. Everything flows from I want. Everything. But in this world, to obtain whatever you want, you must have money. And so it's that love of money that you think that will grant you your fondest wishes, lust of the flesh, and secure power so you can rise above everyone else, which is coveting power. Money is the energy, it's the foundation to make all that happen. And so it's that love of money, though it is often hidden in slogans of patriotism and stuff, it is that love of money that moves history, man's history, the world's history. That's how the world works. And that is how it is working with Judas. He was enticed for money. Not a lot. Like I said, his dreams were small. His ambitions were tiny. And he is actually the impetus or the one that makes it happen to begin this examination. Because remember, they did not know where Jesus was going to be, and the entourage that was sent out with Judas probably didn't know him either, by sight, obviously. Remember, he's in the temple in the Solomon porticles teaching every day of this week. Yet, that's filled with thousands of people. And probably only the few who met him and knew him by sight were not out this night. Because the Sadducees have to remain ceremoniously pure, even though inwardly they're full of dead men's bones. They have to remain ceremoniously pure in order to participate in the sacrifices the next day. So they cannot come out in case they're shedding a blood. And thus the underlings are sent out who probably are not that spiritually or gospelly or religiously oriented. To them, this is their job. And so, Christ's suitability is going to be decided during the next 15 hours or so. Let's say this happens about 9 o'clock at night. In 12 hours, he goes on the Stauros, the tree. He's on the tree for 3 hours before it's determined that he is suitable. We'll cover this again when we get to that part in John. Thus begins the payment for sin for the next 3 hours. Then at the end of those 3 hours, it is done. And he leaves his body. He separates from the body of flesh. He no longer needs it. He has done what he came to do completely. He's handed out the gospel message. He said the very words that the Father wanted him to say. He did the very things that the Father wanted him to do. And then he paid for it so it might be possible for all of us whom Christ saves to come into that. And you have to have this framework in the back of your mind, especially during these latter portions of the gospel. As we go through this, this is the template. And it begins here with this, the beginning of the examination. Now, Judas Iscariot, it means man of the village of Cariot, to distinguish him from the other Judas, because there were two Judases in the band. One was the betrayer, this one, and the other was not. He's coming. Now, he's not the leader of the entourage. He's simply a tool. He's got small ambition. He just wants a few coins. He doesn't want to be boss. He doesn't want to be leader. He just wants to be by himself. He's just a small-minded, mean-minded little man. But guess what all sinners are? Men, women, children. We all are grubbing around in the mud looking for coins, the castaways, the cast-offs of the elite, of the rich and powerful of the world. And he's here just to make sure they arrest the right person. To identify whom Jesus is apart from the other apostles. Though Jesus taught daily in the temple during the week, like I said, he's not recognizable to most people. Now, Isaiah 53, 1 through 3 tells us that his appearance at best could be described as ordinary. He is not the one who's tall and handsome and stands out in the crowd like Saul. That is not what he is. You would not immediately recognize him as a leader, as a man of God. You just wouldn't do that. Christ did not attract people to him because he was handsome, because he exuded this total air of self-confidence that he could move anywhere in the world and people would immediately recognize him as leader and would follow him. The outward appearance was purposely marred. I won't say deformed, but marred so that he would not be attracting people simply because he met their outward standard of a leader, handsome man, like Saul did. Saul was head and shoulders above most men of his day. But he was kind of not a good spiritual role model. He was a short man. Handsome, but short. And he was able to attract people because he was courageous as well as being handsome. But Christ was none of those things. Now, I've included here as an inset on this particular slide, the usual picture of medieval Jesus that was developed during, Renaissance times. It always has him with long hair, nice tan, little trimmed beard, tall, thin, just met everybody's standard during the Renaissance era of this being a noble person. Because that's what Christ would be. A noble person. Whereas right beside that, even though it's labeled real Jesus, I really wouldn't call it real, because we'd never know what he looked like. And he probably had forelocks anyway, since he met the law in every aspect, ceremonially and cultic. So he'd probably have the forelocks anyway. And the talet, the prayer shawl. But this gives us a much better idea of what he might have looked like. Remember, he worked with his hands, working in stone, so he was muscular. He did that up until he began his ministry approximately the age of 30. And he was swarthy. These are dark-complected, dark-skinned people, not like Africans, not like Ethiopians, but they certainly were not pale, or as we might say, Caucasian. He didn't come from Northern Europe. He came from the Middle East. And so we have to remember that most of the pictures that pass for the image of Christ down through history and even today depict an effeminate and Western tradition, which is not correct. He didn't have long hair. He didn't have flowing locks waving in the breeze. Because that would have been a shame to a Jewish man. Not as short probably as we wear ours today, if you're wearing short hair. And he would have had the forelocks. And so what usually passes as an image of Jesus is nothing more than an idol. And it's not true. The other view is probably much closer to Isaiah's description of Jesus. Remember, Isaiah didn't see him either. And we also have to understand the Hebrew kiss of greeting. Now, we have to understand it, even though John does not put it in there. It's not in our text. It's in the other three Gospels. And it's such an iconic event that we have to address it, even though it's not in the Gospel of John. Because people are expecting it. And if we just skip through this, they're going to ask, what happened? Where is it? So we're going to cover it. And it is important to understand what is going on with this kiss. Now, according to the Torah, a kiss is more than just a greeting. That is custom in many parts of the world, even today, for men and to greet men and women to greet women, close friends, associates, political associates, business associates, religious associates, with a kiss. Not on the lips, not having a love fest here, but on the cheek, more than likely, as a sign of trust and greeting. The kiss, it could represent loyalty, as we discussed. It could also represent worship. They would kiss their idols. Or it could represent deceit. Either good kiss, and that's my label, between men displayed trust and respect. And it may also show subordination. The subordinate would kiss the superior. The bad kiss represented betrayal and deception. Now, kissing is represented many times in the Old Testament. We're going to show just two of them. One for the good kiss, one for the bad kiss. Joseph kissed his brothers when revealing himself. Remember, he is Pharaoh's first in command. He's just below Pharaoh. He is the visor. And he's just revealed himself to his brothers who tried to kill him and then sold him into slavery. And this is years later. And he has attained this position of power, and they are coming to him, bowing to him, and they know he has absolute power over their lives. And yet he kisses them as a sign of loyalty and devotion to them. Now, it's not the subordinate kissing the superior, it's the superior reassuring the subordinate. Loyalty, trust. Now, they didn't trust him. And if you read those passages later on, they were scared to death of him most of the time. But he never threatened them. And I guess it's in Genesis 45, verses 4 through 15. Now, Joab, in 2 Samuel 20, verses 4 through 13, he kissed Amasa. But it was deception. It was to get close to Amasa and stab him, kill him. Just lay his, basically gut him. So his guts just flowed out. And the guy was able to see his guts as he died. A very brutal murder. But Joab approached him to kiss him. He was feigning trust, friendship, loyalty, but he was planning something quite different. So Judas, he had this kiss for betrayal. He approached as a friend. He approached as one of the inner band. Now, everyone knows at this point, well, at this point, he's not a member of the inner band anymore. But he's still approaching it like he is. He's being deceitful. And he kissed Christ. Her Judas was not worshiping Christ. Remember, he said that the kiss could also represent worship in 1 Kings 19, verse 18. It shows that they kiss their idols. They kiss those things they worship through. Judas' kiss could also be interpreted as that, because Christ is the Son of Man. And he did tell his apostles that many times, and they even realized it several times in the gospel. They struggled to grasp and understand that. But that's because they didn't have the indwelling spirit yet. However, Judas was not worshiping Christ. He was just using the kiss to get close to Jesus and identify him as the one to be arrested. Deceived. Bad. Had you ever had management allay your fears only to find out that they were laying a trap? They were practicing deceit? That's what Judas was trying to do. However, Christ saw through that. He was never taken in by that. So masquerading as a friend, he was the enemy. Now, whom did Judas bring? And throughout the rest of this lesson, I'm just going to call them the crowd. They don't have a title. You can call them the arresting party if you wish. They're just the crowd. They're not a mob. They're organized. There's a hierarchy there. So it's a crowd. And what was the composition of the crowd that Judas brought? Well, there were the temple soldiers, not Roman soldiers, because Rome isn't involved yet. These are the temple guards that are being sent out. Plus, you have officials. Now, in the ESV, it says officers, but that's not what the Greek means. These are not officers of the soldiers or the temple guard. These are officials. Probably each major group sent along underlings to make sure that this happened the way it was supposed to happen. You don't want guards to get overzealous and start slaughtering people. That will not go well, especially with Rome the next day. And you want to make sure they get the right person, because guards are not the sharpest tacks on the block, especially at the lower ranks. They're hired and trained for one purpose, to kill or be killed. They don't need a lot of intelligence to do that. So these officials, these underlings, probably represented the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Sanhedrin. All these groups, these three groups, had a vested interest in arresting the right person and going through the motions of a trial to have the appearance of applying justice. And thus you had these officials that were sent along to keep the guards in line. So basically, you have local political officials and constabulary. Policemen to you. And Christ addresses this crowd. Now, like I said, this is not included in the other Gospels. And John does not include the kiss in his Gospel. And so, what John does is, he gives this dialogue that was not included in the other Gospels. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just was not included. They focused on the betrayal by one of the inner circle. John is focusing on something different. Christ is the Son of God. And as God, he has omniscience. He knows why they're there. He doesn't need to ask them to inform himself. He already knows. He asks them so that they are clear in their own mind whom it is they're looking for, because they certainly don't know him on sight. And so Jesus asks the crowd, "Whom do you seek?" And they respond, "Jesus of Nazareth." Now, most translations, that's all I can speak to, respond with, "I am he." And they all fall down. Well, that makes absolutely no sense. And it's really not that way in the Greek either. In the Greek, it's ego eimi, or I am. So they came out seeking a man. And they find God. I am is the name of God. Exodus 3:13 through 15. So this explains the crowd's reaction while they fell back or down. Christ said, "I am." They understood what that meant. And they were astounded. He's using the name of God. And I said, not the sharpest tacks on the block. And they're taken aback. They're confused. But they didn't stay confused for long, because the darkness always seeks to suppress the light. Gathering their courage of numbers, they arrested the Son of Man. But now we have to understand how this meshes with the other Gospels. Did these dialogues occur before or after Judas kissed, thus identified Christ? Now, if Judas had already kissed Christ, these dialogues were totally unnecessary. Because Judas had already kissed him, Judas had already identified him, Judas had already fulfilled the purpose for which he had been brought, to point out the true Jesus of Nazareth from the 11 other apostles. Thus it appears that Christ asked them this question, they responded, then Judas kissed him. ensuring in the minds of the crowd that this was indeed Jesus of Nazareth. He was indeed being honest. So Judas was just reinforcing what Christ had already said. Now, Christ's purpose? He was bargaining, basically, for the non-arrest of the apostles to fulfill the scriptures that he lost none of those that were given him. That'd be on the Old Testament, of course. And so, Jesus asked them. They responded, Jesus of Nazareth. He says, I am. They fell back and stumbled. Jesus asked them again, who are you seeking? Jesus of Nazareth. I told you, I am. Or, I am he now. There's no more reason to express his divinity. He's already done that. He did that. He is the light. The darkness could not withstand the light. Then he veils his light so that the darkness may become strong and fulfill its purpose. And we're going to understand why here as we go through now through this part of the lesson. Now, you should be familiar with these two graphics. I've used them several times, both in our studies of Exodus and in our studies in John. Only I've retitled it Son of Man and, small letters, Son of Man. We have to understand the difference here. Jesus is capital Son of Man. That is his title since Daniel 7. He is God. But he's also Son of Man because he came in the form of man, form of sinful man, though without sin, in a body of flesh. He is man. He is Son of Man. He is the last Adam. He is living the 10 words. You may call them the Ten Commandments. In Hebrew, they are the 10 words. He is living them. If you notice, they're divided up on the right-hand portion of the slide with one pyramid representing man's relationship to God and the other side of the pyramid representing how man is supposed to be relating to other people. Notice, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up the pyramid. Then you cross over to the top of the other pyramid and go 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Where covetousness is the foundation. It is the foundation of all sin. And so if you have no covetousness, you will not have to worry about lying and theft and adultery and murder. Because those are just means to obtain what it is you covet. And money is the grease that you use to obtain what it is you covet. Well, Christ, as Son of Man, is living embodiment of the 10 words. Everyone else is a living violation of the 10 words. That's why it's small, Son of Man. But I'm going to reference it directly to Peter. Because without the indwelling Holy Spirit, man cannot live the 10 words. That's just the way it is. Christ can do the Father's will, be arrested, tried, convicted, executed. Peter could not. He could only attempt murder, which of course is sin, which of course flows from covetousness. Now we have to understand this viewpoint, or we're not going to truly understand what is going on. Because through Peter, Lucifer is seeking to tempt Christ not to go to the Saros, not to go to the tree, not to fulfill his mission. Now, Christ knew at least two of the apostles had swords. Luke 9, verse 22, and chapter 22, verse 38. Well, in Luke 9, 22, let's look at that, because it's pertinent to what we need to discuss. And it says, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day raised. Now Christ has been teaching his apostles this must happen. And now is the night when this begins to happen. This is not a shock to anybody. Should not be. He says, this has to happen. And he tells them so that the scriptures might be fulfilled. It's true. The scriptures were given, not so he could come and then try to live them out, but because this was the plan. He was going to do this. And so, through inspiration, he told mankind, especially through his people, the Jews, and their writings, that this was going to happen. So this didn't happen just to fulfill the scriptures. The scriptures were written to explain that this was going to happen. This perspective is vastly different and essential to grasp. And yet Peter obviously didn't grasp it very well. Peter displays the latent hatred of his heart that masqueraded as protective love for Christ. He whipped out that sword. He was going to protect Christ. He was going to charge into the fray. He was going to be the hero. You might say his motives were good, but they were not. They were not good. They were not pure. They definitely were not right. Christ had frequently taught the apostles he must suffer and die for sin, as we just read. And Peter's actions attempted to thwart Christ's ministry. Now, that's sin. It's making him another agent of Lucifer on the spot. And this is not the first time he's been accused of that. He was accused in Matthew 16, verses 21 through 23. For after Peter identified that Christ is the Messiah, and Christ tells him that the Father has the one who has revealed it to him. Peter, you're not that smart. The Father told you this, and you're repeating it. And that's very good, because that's true for all of us. None of us are that smart. And then when Christ says, I must go to Jerusalem and suffer and die, Peter says, no, you can't do that. And Christ, of course, called him an agent of Lucifer. Get behind me, Satan. You're tempting me away from what I need to do. Well, Peter didn't change. This is exactly what he's doing tonight. He carried his weapon. He's ready. The crowd shows up. Now, I don't know how many soldiers there were, enough to control 11 hostile men. And he's going to whip out his sword, not a trained warrior, and go to town. I mean, you would see this in a movie. In real life, you'd be dead. And so, while Judas is the obvious betrayer, and Peter, if you ask him, he's going to be very sincere. He's not deceitfully sincere. He truly believes he's sincere and doing the right thing. But he's that subtle agent of temptation. That could be the wife at your elbow, or the husband, or the pastor, or the president. Being sincere, but being sinful. How can you tell? What are the results? What are the goals of the action? The goal of the action here is to kill. Violates the 10th word. The 6th word. Do not murder. This is not defense. Christ is not making a defense. He did not want a defense. He did not come to be the hero. He came to be the lamb. Peter wants to be the hero. And if Peter is going to be the symbol of the coming church, he cannot be violent, because that establishes a church predicated on violence. And we're going to address that topic again at the end of the lesson, because obviously that didn't take very well either. So Christ must resist both temptations to stop his arrest and subsequent sacrificial death. If Peter stops his arrest, thus stops his execution, there is no salvation for Peter. This is absolute nihilism. And Peter is not thinking this through at all. But if he stops this, he has no hope. He will suffer an eternity in his sin. There will be no hope for anyone. This has to occur. It must occur. In fact, it will occur. This was the purpose of God from eternity past, and it will not be thwarted. And Peter strikes the king. Peter hacked off the right ear of the high priest's slave. If your translation says servant, scratch it out. These were not hired servants. These were slaves. possibly a steward to manage the high priest's household. Remember, this is a slave in the high priest's house. He's not sending out a common slave with his crew. He's sending out probably one of his chief stewards as his representative. We don't understand those forms of slavery, but they're very common in the ancient world. Daniel was a slave. Stayed a slave. Joseph was a slave. Stayed a slave. Even though Joseph was second in command, was the vizier of Pharaoh over all Egypt, he was still a slave. When he went to bury his father in Canaan, Pharaoh sent an entourage to make sure that Joseph came back. So we have to grasp the intricacies that were lost in this form of slavery that was usually practiced in America, or at least has been perpetuated down to our time from that slave period in American history. And thus, the name of the slave meant king. Now, it was an actual name, probably. That was just the meaning of that name. But in the Old Testament economy, names usually designated position or character. And Christ had just obtained the release from arrest when Peter does his sinful, violent act that could have resulted in their arrest and execution as dangerous criminals to both Jews and Romans. They could have been mistaken for zealots. Just like I talked about on the last slide. Do you propagate the truth of God with the sword? If you do, your intentions, your motivations are always suspect. Are you doing it because you want people to be saved, or are you doing it because you want to enlarge your territory? You want to rob them of what wealth they may have. You want to enslave them to meet your goals. Sin always breeds violence. Always. If what you're doing breeds violence, then it is wrong. Now, it may cause others to be violent to you. Like here, they're going to be very violent toward Christ to the point they're going to execute him. That's not what I'm saying. But if you are using violence, it will only breed more violence against you. That, you know, what is it causing you to do? Well, the new nature yields peace. Doesn't mean they're going to be peaceful towards you because the world hates you. But it means that you should be peaceful. Peter needs more discipline, more testing. And guess what? He's going to get it. That's the whole point of Christ warning Peter that he is going to be tested. And he's revealing here why he's going to be tested. Because he needs more discipline. Hebrews 12:11. So he may learn peacefulness. Turn to Hebrews 12:11. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The peaceful fruit of righteousness. Peter's going to need to learn that peaceful fruit of righteousness. He's not the only one. Many Christians today need to learn that peaceful fruit of righteousness. And also, it's one of the fruits of the Spirit. Galatians 5:22. If you are in the Spirit, you will have peace. You will exude peace. Thus, Christ has to reprimand Peter. Call him down. Peter's actions ignored all of Christ's teachings. Christ could have called upon 12 legions of angels. Let's just say that's a whole lot of angels. They could have leveled the earth. Christ didn't need protection from man. That's almost silly. He had all the protection he ever needed, constantly. But he's God. He doesn't need their protection. And those who live by the sword, die by the sword. Galatians 6:7-8. If Peter was going to live by that sword, he's going to die by it. And we never see a sword in his hand again throughout the rest of the New Testament. Nor do we see a sword in the hand of anyone who's preaching the gospel throughout the rest of the New Testament, ever. Those who use the world's ways suffer by those ways. Whatever you reap, you will sow it. And if you're reaping violence through your violence, you will. If you're sowing violence through your violence, you are going to reap violence. If you want peace, you must first be peace. Christianity cannot be spread via violence, ever. Ever. Let me say that again. Ever. If you're spreading the gospel via the sword, that's not the gospel. Roman Catholicism did that for 1,000 years. That's not the gospel. Protestantism did that since its inception, when it became allied with newly forming nation states to spread its gospel via the sword. You can't do that either. It is wrong. Islam spreads its form of gospel by violence. It's wrong. It demonstrates it's wrong. Confucianism claims to be peaceful, but it's nihilistic. You return to nirvana and become nothing. Well, I don't know anybody who wants to be a nothing. Atheism teaches nihilism. You die, you die. There's nothing after that. Well, what's the point of doing anything then? Eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we die. Who cares? That's nihilistic also. That's not a true gospel, and that's not true peace. You don't live peace with all people as an atheist. You try to squash all ideas that do not agree that atheism is the only idea. And Christ tells the crowd that this is their hour, the power of darkness. He tells them directly. He's revealed he is the light when he said, I am. He's acknowledged who he is twice now. The 4 days examination, four in the Bible, is the number of justice. Now he's going to suffer under the world's form of justice, which is not justice at all. And then he's going to suffer under God's justice, which is true justice, standing in for everyone who has ever been saved throughout history, taking our penalty, our punishment upon himself. And the darkness seeks to overcome the light rather than turn to the light. It always does this. And yet, this is spoken about in the opening hymn, John chapter 1, verse 5 and verses 9 through 11. The light came, the darkness didn't want it. Darkness wanted to squash the light. The world's always in darkness, hating the light. Always. Do not be confused, dear people. There is never peace with the world. Oh, we have peace in the world. We're not at war with the world. We're in the world, not of the world. But the world is at war with us. It will always be at war with us, but it cannot overcome Christ. The light illumines the darkness, seeking to save. If you follow along in the handout, there's the graphic of the lighthouse. In the midst of the storm at night, the waves and the wind crashing. And yet, the light shines out into the dark, unmoved, seeking whom to save. Peaceful. Peaceable. And they lead Jesus away. The crowd arrests Jesus, leading him back to Jerusalem to begin his sacrificial paschal examination. Now, they're going to find him sinful. Not that their opinion matters a whole lot. God finds him sinless. Now, two disciples follow Jesus. One is John, described as a young man, and this is in Mark 14, 51 through 52. Just remember, Mark is the youngest of the group. He's probably 18, maybe 20. Very young man compared to the other apostles. Well-to-do. Comes from a family that has influence, as we're going to see later on, and as we talked about very early on in our study in the gospel. And yet, he followed too closely. And one of the guards tried to grab him, but they just grabbed his garment, and he twisted out of his garment and ran away naked. That means he had a loincloth on. That doesn't mean, because Jewish men wore loincloths. That doesn't mean he was totally naked. But he ran off, leaving his garment behind. But Peter was also following long behind, but not so close as to get caught. And so this tells us how warm a night it is. It's the fact that John only has, you know, the robe on. He doesn't have an outer garment covering his robe or anything like that. So when they grab that, he just twists out of it and away he goes. So Peter probably helped to reclothe John because they're still following along behind, and it's going to be fairly obvious you got a naked or a man with just a loincloth following along, because they're going to go into Jerusalem and that's just not going to go well. So at some point John reclothes himself, and these two will follow Christ to the high priest's house, which is where the trial will be held at. However, they're not going directly to the high priest's house. Only John records that Jesus was first taken to Annas' house, who was father-in-law to Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And you have to remember that this is a syndicate. It is a crime syndicate. And that Annas is the power behind Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the front man. He's at the temple. He's controlling the selling and getting cuts and all of this. And so these are very, very rich men. They have influence with the Romans. They've also ticked the Romans off from time to time. And the reason Annas is not a high priest is that even the Romans couldn't stand him after a while. And so he just passed the mantle over to his son-in-law. He's still the power, but now Caiaphas is the front man. Now we're going to cover in more detail in our next lesson what occurred when Christ was led to Annas' house. Suffice it to say that no lawyer wants to ask a question they do not know the answer to, because you cannot control the outcome. And as a lawyer, you want to have that absolute control over the outcome. You do not want any surprises. So I think that's why Christ was taken to Annas' house first, so that Annas could question him, was certain what Christ was going to say, and then send him on to the Sanhedrin for formal trial. And like I said, we're going to cover this in more detail in the next lesson. But suffice it to say, once again, that John is the only one who recorded this. And he must have recorded it for this very reason, to show that these men were working at night behind the scenes in darkness, but they were also agents of darkness, agents of Lucifer. Unwittingly, if you were to ask them, they would have no clue what you were asking them and why. But in point of fact, these are Lucifer's agents. And we see this constantly today. People unwittingly are becoming, or are, because that's what the lost are, agents of Lucifer in some degree or another. Usually, the vast majority, unwittingly, unknowingly actually, but still carrying out the will of Lucifer and advancing his plan one incremental notch at a time, which brings him closer and closer to his own destruction. As in his own wisdom, he will be shown to be foolish, falling into his own pit that he has made for others. The basis of John's gospel is the war of darkness against light. This is the backdrop of John's gospel as highlighted in the opening hymn. We've touched on it many times. This is also the central theme of the Bible. Creation depicts light shining into the chaos of darkness, bringing order, peace, and grace. Let there be light, and the light shone out into the darkness. And from that moment on, each subsequent speaking brings order to the chaos of that original creation. When man sinned, that'd be the first Adam, darkness reigned in the world, and light intervened, bringing salvation, peace with God. Romans 5:6-11. Now the world walks in darkness and therefore considers the darkness, which is sin, normal. Humanity willingly or ignorantly loves darkness, considering their condition to be light, which is delusional. It's a delusion. God gives them up to follow their dictates, which always results in degradation and violence. Romans 1:18-32. Even the best of a world yields death and degradation. That's what it does. Thus, the true methodology of sin, of darkness, is usually hidden until the last moment. When I say the world, I primarily mean Lucifer. He trades in violence. That's what he does. His sin immediately yielded violence. And because all sinners have the nature of their father, Lucifer, Satan is his title, Lucifer is his name, they also have a propensity to violence. When people get hungry and there's no food, they riot. When prices rise or tax rises threatening to make them poor, they riot. When they get angry as a community of some perceived social injustice, they riot. When they don't get what they think should be their rights, you got it, they riot. You think you've been violated, your rights or your honor has been violated, you go kill somebody. You go confront them and beat them up. You're going to make them yield to you one way or the other. That's sin. That's how we work. That is in our movies. That is in our music. That is in our books to do that. False history is written to hide the true methods and goals of the world behind a facade of peace and goodness. The world's replete with false history. Governments, especially government-run public schools, teach false history that's favorable to that government, hiding their wrongs, hiding their violent methodologies. You know why we know the Bible is true? Because God doesn't do that. When Saul did wrong, Bible says Saul sinned. When David committed adultery with Bathsheba, guess what? Bible said that. Didn't hide it. Didn't cover it up. It said the sword will never depart from David's house. Well, guess what? Absalom rebelled and led a coup against David, forcing him out of Jerusalem. Why? David sinned. Bible tells us that. Peter, top dog apostle, whips out a sword, whacks off a guy's ear. Christ says to heal it, restore it. Violence. Christ doesn't condone it. The world does condone it by trying to rewrite history. True history, usually called revisionist, reveals the true methods and goals. But you know, it's still rejected by the majority of the world. And because the majority of the world is sinful, it really doesn't matter. I mean, the revisionist history is so that we understand those influences. It reveals them and unmasks them. It proves the truth of the scriptures. It's not going to change history. It's not going to make it better in the future. But it proves the truth of the scriptures. And God allows people to be deluded by the lie of Lucifer. 2 Thessalonians 2:9-12. The true methodology revealed. The next few lessons will reveal the true methodology of the world. Violence and death. We're going to see this trial and its violence and how it results in violence. We're going to see the violence of the crowd and the violence of the Romans. Everywhere Christ is being met with violence. Lucifer was the author of lies and murders. John 8:44. Lucifer's major weapon since he sinned, Ezekiel 28:16, as I just touched on earlier, is violence. World's wars. I mean, the world wars, but I mean the wars of the world are just naked violence. Reveals its true nature. James 4:1-4. Why is there violence among you? Why are there wars? Because you want, and you go get it, and you're going to get it at the expense of others. Because you look upon it as a closed pie, and so you have to take from others. Whereas, that's not what it is at all. It is not a closed system. You can produce wealth. You can produce what you think you need, you want, by just developing new products or new processes or changing your wantus. And any who claim Christianity but promote violence reveals they are aligned with Lucifer, not with Christ, which is most of church history. Roman Catholics, the Greek Orthodox, spread their gospel by the sword, especially to indigenous populations around the world. Well, until the 19th century, late 18th and into the 19th century, the missionaries started going out around the world in droves, peacefully, bringing the gospel. Protestantism, like I said, aligned with governments. And those terrible wars in Europe, those religious wars, were all wrong. Protestantism is Catholicism, Catholicism against Protestantism. If you have the true gospel, you will not pick up that sword. That's not speaking against self-defense when you are attacked in your home or you're trying to protect your family. We're not talking about that. That's recognized as proper in the Old Testament and carries over into the New Testament. We're talking about taking the gospel out. We're talking about our interactions with others. And exactly this methodology of Peter that Christ rebuked. It is antithetical to the gospel of peace. And you know, this is engulfing evangelicals today that are aligning with their governments to promote national violence. We're going to see another war here. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be pretty. They never are. And at the end, there'll just be more people enslaved. World War I, the war to end all wars, developed such an oppressive peace that everyone knew it was going to reemerge as another world war, which it did 20 years later. That war was supposed to promote democracy around the world, yet at the end of the war, there were more people enslaved under tyranny than there were when the war started. And there was more butchery going on after the war. That was common knowledge and allowed to continue. It was just, you read these things and you're going, how can people who claim to be Christians allow this? Not scream out that this is not Christ in action. And today, it is evangelicals that scream for more government power, more police power, more like Peter, taking out a sword and charging into the fray to protect the church. Christ's church doesn't need protection. He is God. When it's your time to come to Him, it will come. And whatever He has us go through, He went through it first. And we're going to see that. We should be meditating and preparing our minds for the gospel of peace, not the gospel of Peter. Now, Peter is going to learn and mend his ways. Will we? I'm afraid that many of those that I talk to do not want to mend their ways. And that fills me with a dreadful concern for what the future will yield for all of us. Thank you.